Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we report on the difficulty people in the U.S. and other countries are having in sending money to Somalia.
It's the only country that has experienced two famines in modern history.
Then we report on the confusion in Vietnam about the government's approach to gay marriage. The challenges for money transfer companies sending money to Somalia, and gay marriages in Vietnam, now legal, but not recognized by the government. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America, and this is our daily program, As It Is. Somalis in the United States are now unable to send money back to Somalia. The final American bank that allowed for sending money there has stopped doing so. The small Merchants Bank of California was the last bank in the United States that worked with Somali American transfer companies. Those companies operate in the same way as the worldwide money transfer companies Western Union and MoneyGram. But they permit people to send money to rural areas of Somalia, far from cities and towns. This month, however, Merchants Bank stopped helping the companies send money to Somalia. Anti-terror legislation had stopped most American banks from giving people a way to send money to Somalia. Experts say more than 1 million Somalis cannot feed themselves. Many Somalis depend on the money sent to them by their friends and family members in the United States and other countries to survive. Sunrise Community Bank in the U.S. and Barclays Bank in Britain have also closed their Somali transfer accounts. They were worried that the transfer companies were either working directly with terrorists or that the money being sent to Somalia was being given to terrorists. The United Nations and humanitarian workers warn that Merchants Bank's decision will hurt Somalia. The money transfer business there is huge. The United Nations and aid groups in Somalia use money transfers to pay their workers and to pay for projects in small villages and towns. Aid groups such as Oxfam and Adesso, a non-governmental organization, estimate that Somalis living outside the country send more than $1 billion home every year. Degan Ali leads the aid group Adesso. She says banks should continue to work with the money transfer companies.
We need an immediate solution, and what we propose is that there be an exception to the case of Somalia because it's the only country that has experienced two famines in modern history. It's a country where there's this active conflict and people are highly food insecure.
Somalia's government collapsed in 1991. Since then, hundreds of thousands of Somalis have been able to eat only because people living outside the country sent them money. Oxfam said in a statement that it has warned officials for the past few years about the severe effect on the country of banks refusing to work with the companies. It also said the end of the transfers will worsen Somalia's humanitarian crisis. An Oxfam spokesman told the Los Angeles Times newspaper that criminal gangs will now become involved with sending money into Somalia. You are listening to As It Is on the Voice of America. Thang Ai Ling is a Vietnamese woman who has been married to another woman for 14 years. In the past few months, she has seen an increase in the number of people in Vietnam putting photographs and stories from gay weddings on Facebook. Those pictures and stories are a big change for Vietnam. 15 years ago, Vietnamese officials banned gay marriage. The Law on Marriage and Family and other rulings let officials stop same-sex wedding ceremonies and force people to pay a fine of $24. Sometimes the officials acted because they opposed homosexuality. Others sought to be paid bribes to permit the ceremonies to continue. Thang Ai Linh says some officials stopped the weddings just because, in her words, they want to cause trouble for us. But on January 1st, 2015, a new law removed criminal penalties for same-sex marriages. As Jim Tedder now reports, the law has made Vietnam a leader in protecting gay rights in Southeast Asia.
Many homosexual, bisexual, and transgendered Vietnamese believe officials will now no longer try to stop weddings for same-sex couples. However, the law also says the state does not recognize marriage between people of the same sex. The language has caused confusion for some gay Vietnamese. Nguyen Tan Phat operates a photography and design company with his boyfriend. He says he does not understand why the government would not recognize gay marriages if it does not ban them. What does that mean we can do? He says. It's really unclear. The new law also surprised many people because the governments of the nearby countries of Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore have not loosened restrictions on homosexuals. In contrast, government officials in Vietnam have approved celebrations and gatherings by large groups of homosexuals, and lawmakers have debated whether the government should recognize gay marriage. Observers say one reason Vietnam can consider the issue is because it is a communist country, and religious groups rarely influence lawmakers there. Religious groups are often the strongest opponents of same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage supporters also say the issue of gay marriage does not threaten officials' hold on power the way other rights issues might. Chan Hak Tung is the director of the gay rights group ICS. Mr. Tung says almost every Vietnamese official he has spoken to now supports gay rights. Mr. Tung says the canceling of the gay marriage ban is just the latest sign of success. He says the change, in his words, sends a message to the public of the position of the government, that it is moving to more acceptance and tolerance of lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgendered people. He says the government is even asking organizations like his to attend sessions in which laws are written. He says the invitation gives ICS credibility as an interest group during the policymaking process. Mr. Tung adds that the growing support from parents, the media, and the public, in his words, creates pressure for the government to act. He says the issue of gay rights and legalization of same-sex marriage has been raised before, but nothing happened because there was no backup from society. Now that has changed. Like in the United States, Vietnam appears to be preparing for national legalization and recognition of same-sex marriages. I'm Jim Tedder.
And that's our program for today. I'm Christopher Cruz at the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Experts estimate that one out of every five fish sold was caught illegally. They say the illegal fishing market is worth $23.5 billion a year. It threatens food security and hurts the environment. Officials are using new observational technology to fight illegal fishing.
Hello to everybody. Thank you for taking the time to join us here in Harwell in the Operations Center to what we call Project Eyes on the Sea.
That is Tony Long. He leads the Ending Illegal Fishing Program for Pew Charitable Trust. The group created Project Eyes on the Seas. Large three-dimensional images of a globe can be seen on a video that plays behind him.
It looks different to what you might expect because this globe only shows you the vessels that are coming into this system from a live automated information system, or AIS.
The screen shows there are 120,000 fishing boats that have AIS. They are required to have the technology. But those who are fishing illegally often turn it off. The technology does not tell observers when that happens. Project Eyes on the Seas combines satellite information with secret government records on every ship's past activities.
The same system as the fishing vessels use to predict where the fish are going to be, we can bring that environmental source into this data.
Mr. Long says that permits investigators to understand exactly where the fishing boats are operating. The Pew team gives the information it gathers to port officials to help them decide if they should take action against a ship. The Pacific Island nation of Palau was an early user of the technology. Palau has one of the richest fishing areas in the world and wants to protect it. Last year, it announced a plan to ban commercial fishing in a 630,000 square kilometer area. KB Sukuma is a special advisor to the president of Palau. He says Palau is trying to deal with a recent increase in illegal, unsupervised, and unreported fishing.
And it's come to a head in the last year or two where our southern island, in the evening, you can see on the horizon just dotted lights of these illegal fishermen that come into our waters, fill their holds with our fish, our resources, our food security.
Mr. Sukuma hopes the information from the project will help Palau fight fishing piracy. And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation,
American History in VOA Special English. Rutherford Hayes was sworn into office as the 19th President of the United States in 1877. Hayes, a Republican, became president after a disputed election. Representatives of his party and the Democrats met secretly to work out a compromise. The Democrats agreed to let Hayes be sworn in. In return, he agreed to end federal support of radical Republican governments in the South. He promised to name Southerners to his cabinet and other important jobs. And he said he would provide more federal aid for schools and railroads in the South. As part of the agreement, Hayes promised not to act aggressively to support the civil rights of black Southerners. This week in our series, Steve Ember and Richard Rail tell the story of Rutherford Hayes.
Rutherford Hayes was born in Ohio in 1822. He was a good student at Kenyon College and at Harvard Law School. He opened a law office in Cincinnati. When he was 30 years old, he married Lucy Webb. Later, he served as an officer in the Union Army during America's Civil War. He was elected to the United States House of Representatives. He also served as governor of Ohio. In this job, he helped establish the college that became Ohio State University.
Hayes was a Republican. In 1876, he was the party's compromise candidate for president. His opponent in the national election was Democrat Samuel Tilden. Tilden won more popular votes than Hayes. In the American political system, whoever wins the most popular votes in a state usually gets all the electoral votes of that state. In 1876, both the Republicans and Democrats claimed the electoral votes of three southern states, Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina. So it was not clear at first who had won the presidential election.
Congress appointed a committee to decide the issue. The committee had a Republican majority. It gave the disputed electoral votes to Hayes. He won the election by just one electoral vote. The results came just a few days before the inauguration. Democrats protested that the Republicans had stolen the election. Yet they agreed to accept Hayes as president. In exchange, Hayes and the Republicans agreed to accept Democratic Party policies on several issues. Hayes's administration would deal mainly with national, not international, problems.
At first, people wondered, would President Hayes keep the promises that were made to help him win the election? Most thought he would not. Hayes surprised everyone. In his inaugural speech, he promised to put the country ahead of the party. He said, "He serves his party best who serves his country best." Party leaders told Hayes which men to appoint to his cabinet. He refused and made his own choices. He ordered federal troops to withdraw from South Carolina and Louisiana. The troops had been there since the end of the Civil War. He also helped Southern Democrats establish new governments in their states.
Republican Party leaders criticized President Hayes. Anti-slavery groups also criticized him. They said former black slaves in the South had gained a lot under Republican rule. Now, they said, these black Americans would lose everything. Hayes did not agree. He had received promises that the new Democratic state governments would protect the rights of black Americans. It was not to be. White Democrats kept political control in some southern states for many years. They often denied civil rights to black citizens. Only with the rise of the civil rights movement in the 1950s would the situation begin to change.
After becoming president, Rutherford Hayes announced that he would serve just one term. He wanted to make serious reforms in the federal government. This would be easier to do if he did not have to worry about getting reelected. Hayes started by changing the system that employed people in government jobs. Party leaders usually had great power to fill government jobs. They used the jobs to reward loyal party workers and to increase their own political strength. President Hayes demanded that federal jobs be given to people because of their abilities, not because they supported a politician.
At that time, the best jobs were with the Customs Service of the Treasury Department. The people who collected customs, taxes on imports, could keep part of the money they collected. President Hayes took action against the Customs Service office in New York City. One of the men removed from the job there was James Garfield. Garfield would later become President of the United States. Hayes also banned all federal workers from taking part in political organizations, conventions, and campaigns. And he said politicians no longer could demand campaign money from federal workers.
Rutherford Hayes showed more political strength during a nationwide railroad strike. The strike began during his first summer as president. For several years, the nation had suffered from a serious economic depression. 3 million people were out of work. Factories and businesses reduced the pay of those who still had jobs. Workers with the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad protested. They took control of many areas along the railroad. They refused to let the trains move. The strike spread to other railroads. In some places, the strikes turned into riots, and the riots became violent. Some governors ordered their state armed forces to intervene. The state forces were not strong enough, however. So the governors asked President Hayes for help. He immediately sent federal troops to troubled cities. The troops stopped the riots and ended the strikes.
Another issue during Hayes's administration involved a railroad in the western United States. It was both a labor problem and an immigration problem. Thousands of Chinese workers had been brought to America to help build the Central Pacific Railroad. After the railroad was built, many of them remained. Most settled in California. Others came from China to join them. These immigrants competed with white workers for jobs. Whites protested because the Chinese agreed to work for less money. They said this kept wages down for all workers.
The white workers asked Congress for a law to stop Chinese workers from coming to the United States. Members of Congress from both parties wanted the support of these voters, so they quickly passed a bill that made it much more difficult for Chinese citizens to come to live in the United States. The bill said the president must cancel part of a treaty between the United States and China. That part of the treaty permitted citizens of each country to settle in the other country.
President Hayes vetoed the bill. He said the United States had proposed the treaty. So, he said, the United States could not change it without agreement from China. Hayes did agree, however, that some action was necessary. So he opened negotiations with the Chinese government. He won an agreement to limit the number of Chinese who could enter the United States.
During the administrations of Andrew Johnson and Ulysses Grant, Congress had weakened many powers of the president. Congress had become the strongest of the three branches of American government. Throughout his administration, Rutherford Hayes worked hard to strengthen presidential powers. For example, the United States Constitution gives the president power to veto bills passed by Congress. In the 1800s, Congress tried to prevent presidential vetoes. It used a method of attaching riders to legislative proposals. This is how the method works.
Congress considers a bill the president believes is necessary. Then it joins that bill to a measure the president would veto if passed separately. The extra measure is called a rider to the first bill. To get the bill he wants, the president must accept the rider, too. President Hayes refused to sign any bills with riders. So the Congress, during his administration, stopped using the method. Congresses since then have used it successfully.
Rutherford Hayes kept his promise to serve only 4 years. He did not regret his decision. After leaving office in 1881, he said he was satisfied with what he had done. He looked back on his administration and wrote, "I left this country prosperous and happy. I left the party of my choice strong, victorious, and united. In serving the country, I served my party." He died in 1893.
Hayes was right in saying that the United States was strong and prosperous. The late 1800s were a time of growth for the nation. They also were a time of expansion into new territory. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by David Jarmel. The narrators were Steve Ember and Richard Rail. Our programs can be found online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.